This Week, Eskimo Dances. Then, Roger Lang and Mitch Dimentov discuss Justice in the Bush with two representatives of the Alaska State Troopers. Potlatch, a program about Alaska Natives for Alaska Natives. Once again, music from the album Alaskan Eskimo Songs and Stories, produced by Lorraine Caranda and the University of Washington Press in cooperation with the Alaska Festival of Music. Eskimo dancers, even when they are dancing together, never hold hands or touch each other. Each dancer dances alone. The women's motions are very graceful, and the movement of the body is usually limited to a very small space. The knees are slightly bent, and the body moves in swaying and dipping motions in a most flowing and graceful style. The dancer takes very short, shuffling steps and does not move far during the course of the dance. Women generally keep their eyes modestly cast down in deference to the men who are performing. The men dance with great vigor and strength, shifting their weight from one foot to the other and stamping in time to the music. Bold arm movements are used to underline the rhythm of the accompaniment or tell the story of the song. They hold their heads up, and the expressions on their faces as the dance mounts in excitement convey a sense of great masculine beauty and freedom. Often, if the music or story suggests it, a keen sense of humor is reflected on the dancer's face and those of the accompanying singers. In addition to the acting dances or motion dances previously mentioned, there are common dances, or those in which anyone who wishes may dance, using any pattern of movement he desires. This type of dancing is also called a muscle dance, although the term may once have referred to an actual rippling of the muscles, a dance style mentioned in earlier days but now seen infrequently. A very unusual kind of dancing originated at Diomede Island, became popular at Wales, and has been copied elsewhere on the mainland. This is the bench dance, in which the performers, usually women, are seated on a bench and move their arms and upper torsos in unison. Special songs are composed for the bench dances. The following bench dance song from Barrow is sung by a couple from Point Barrow, and Dick Bult was made in imitation of one from Wales. It was composed about a century ago by an old grandmother who sang it to amuse and instruct her grandchildren. We hear now the bench dance song. The next bench dance song, sung by Blanche Lincoln of Kotzebue, is performed as an umiak paddling song with appropriate motions by the seated dancers. We hear now the umiak paddling song. Next is a song for a women's motion dance sung by Roseanne Negovana and Nani Kagak of Wainwright. The text consists of neutral syllables and does not tell a story. We hear now the women's dance song.
Ay 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 ay
The dances usually take place in the Kasigi, which in days long ago was the center of activity for all hunting rituals, ceremonies, storytelling, singing and dancing, and the training of young boys. At that time, it was a haven for the men and boys of the village. The women entered only to bring food, to prepare the hall for rituals, and occasionally to participate in them. Today, the social hall is a community center no longer restricted primarily to men's activities. It was quite common for the village to have two or more competitive men's societies, each with its own kasigi. The situation is rarely found today, although there are still two active groups at Point Hope. In the social hall, the drummers sit on the floor in a line. The singers gather behind them, and the dancers take the center. At the height of the performance, the throbbing drums and strident nasal voices of the singers produce an almost terrifying effect. The non-Eskimo listener may at first be overwhelmed by the combined sounds, but is likely to be carried along by the pulsating wave of sound and finally to have the impulse to join the performers. Visitors to the dance program are usually invited to join in the dancing. A conspicuous element of the Eskimo's dancing costume is gloves. These may be highly ornamental gauntlet gloves, specially designed dance gloves with feathers on each fingertip, or just ordinary winter mittens or canvas work gloves. Anything will do, as long as the hands are covered, although occasionally the gloves are held rather than worn. The Eskimos traditionally cover their hands when they dance, but they're uncertain for the reason for this. One possible explanation they suggest is that the hands were covered as a gesture of respect to the spirits controlling weather, hunting, and animals, in whose honor the dances were originally performed. Another is that the gloves were a protection against contact with evil spirits. A special song from St. Lawrence Island honors the dance gloves. The father of the singer, Hazel Amwari, composed this song for a dancer friend as a gift that accompanied unusually handsome dancing gloves with amulets adorning them. The dancer was extremely proud of these mittens, which became a pattern for other St. Lawrence dance gloves. We hear now the Dance Mitt Song. Ornamental dance gloves usually had amulets made of bird beaks, ivory, or bone attached to them. These were good luck charms and also added a pleasant percussive sound as the dancer moved his hands. Such ornaments as empty shell cases were also sometimes used on the gloves for their tinkling metallic sounds. A favorite adornment was the loon headdress. On a band fitting snugly around the dancer's head was fastened a dried loon head with beak. Loon feathers decorated the flaps which fell over the dancer's ears. This headdress was used in the messenger feast ceremonial dances and in the colorful loon dances of the northern coast, in which the dancer used bird-like motions to imitate with great humor the bird movements of one of the most elegant of the world's birds, the Pacific or Arctic loon. Two very ancient loon dance tunes from Point Barrow are sung by the Barrow couple and Dick Balt. It is not known if there was a text for the songs. In any case, the words are no longer remembered, and the syllables are only for convenience in singing. We hear the Loon Dance Song number 1 and the Loon Dance Song number 2. From King Island comes a very special King Loon song sung by John Hoolana. The hunter has seen the beautiful but raucous voiced bird. The text says, "What is this that I see? Is it an animal or a bird? It's a King Loon. I wish I were able to sing just like that bird." We hear now the King Loon song. John Hoolana and the King Loon Song. Our thanks to Mr. Hoolana and Lorraine Kuranda, the University of Washington Press, and the Alaska Festival of Music. Last June, during the Bush Justice Conference in Minto, I interviewed Mitch Nemantoff and Roger Lang about fish and game protection in rural areas, about relationships of natives and law officers in the bush, and about hiring natives for law enforcement. Mitch Nemantoff responded to my question whether the state should ban hunting by non-natives in areas near native villages.
You'd have to go on, I think, on a specific case that you can't just go across the board and say that, you know, that you can hunt here and you can hunt here and right on down the line. You're going to have to take it by a specific case. It should be left to a local community because it's their immediate resource, although in theory or by law, the resource belongs to all the people in the state of Alaska. I think that it's firstly their immediate resource because of the different needs that they have for the game. So, you know, again, rather than making a flat statement, it should be, you know, done on a situation basis.
Who's going to be making that decision?
In the past, the decisions have been made by the Department of Fish and Game, by their board of directors, and they've had consultation with village people on a sporadic basis, primarily because, like, the board meets maybe in Juneau, and there are very few people who can actually afford to go to Juneau to testify, and the staff solicits recommendations, but basically to get that real grassroots input. They have to come to the villages, and that just hasn't been done yet. So as a result, oftentimes decisions are made by those outside of rural Alaskan villages.
I pointed out that an exception made to whale hunting laws for subsistence Eskimo hunters. I asked if the state should exempt subsistence village hunters from state fish and game regulations.
I believe that they're, I don't know if you want to say exception so well, but I believe that in certain situations where there is an excessive amount of subsistence use, that should definitely be given preference in establishing any laws.
To all other uses of that resource.
Right.
Yeah, and there is ample precedent for this type of thing. As to constitutionality, the state blithely ignores the constitutionality of educational provisions for all citizens of the state, and it can ignore whatever it needs to ignore.
I asked if the state troopers provide training by natives to acculturate state troopers to village life. Speaking for the troopers, the current acting commissioner of public safety, Donald McQueen.
There's been guest lecturers at our State Trooper Academy. They're usually the one that I can think of in particular. I'm not certain the numbers of times that he's been there. I know of one instance in particular, and I think that was Dr. Soboloff, who attended one of our sessions, and dealing with some cultural problems. And we are expanding our academy and trying to keep in time with the times. And these things are things that we bring into our curriculum that is constantly changing because of demands and necessity to meet these problems.
I asked if there should be a training program similar to the proposed training program for non-native pipeline workers to acculturate them to working with Alaska Natives. Roger Lang replied.
Sure, I think that, they keep telling us we need to cross the cultural bridge or whatever it is. And it's really a two-way street. There are needs that natives have too, which will not be found in the other culture. And I think that, it never hurts anybody to learn something good. And the native culture is a good culture. It's a law-abiding culture. It's one which didn't have welfare systems, or policemen, or anything else. And it survived in the harshest climate in the world, simply because people had to work with each other. And that has a lot to offer to any society.
I asked what the starting salary was for state troopers as of last June. The state trooper in charge of training village police officers, Chuck Reed, answered,
I would say that it's about $1,140 a month.
McQueen compared this salary with that of a village police officer.
The salary range for those village policemen presently employed runs from zero to approximately $700, depending on the village's ability to pay salaries.
Lang comments on the differences in salary.
$1,140 a month is not, in 1974, not the greatest salary in the world either. I can see recruiting problems for the state troopers there. And the village problem, of course, is predicated on the village's ability to pay their policemen. And again, you come to the old revenue question. And you come to the priority of the use of state money. In my mind, the highest priority for state use of money is for its citizenry. And again, this relates to what does the state do? In this case, nothing, as it relates to village police, and very little as it relates to Alaska troops. You heard the man say there's 188 of them to do this whole state. And frankly, the politicians can talk philosophy to me forever. And until they put a dollar into programs, then I'm going to start believing.
Dementov says some villagers regard state troopers as Gestapos. He suggests ways to enhance understanding between the troopers and the villagers.
there are situations, many situations, where the troopers do consult with councils in the local villages, and that does much to bridge a communications gap between the trooper and his activities and the village people and their concerns for their community. We do not want to direct troopers once they get or inhibit any investigations, merely to enhance communications, to provide cooperation within a community so that you don't have the Gestapo-like attitude, so that you have a feeling, so that the people in the villages have a feeling that the trooper's there for their benefit as well as for the purposes in which the trooper might come into the village.
I asked if people in villages consider state troopers as racists.
I'd have to say that is a pretty general, you're asking for a pretty general statement. I'm sure that there have been isolated cases in Alaska where that has been found, but I don't think that anyone can make that in a general statement.
No, that is, we don't make that charge like. It's not a thing that we go around hollering about from the treetops. And when we make it, we generally can back it up very quickly with hard evidence. And you ask a part of a question about Mitch, which I think needs to be reiterated in this morning's discussion. At no time did I ever hear anybody say, we don't want law, we don't want order, we don't want police enforcement. It's just how best to use what's available that kept coming up in this whole discussion. I think the Native groups as a whole, here I will generalize, are probably the most law-abiding people I know, and it's very evident in the amount of money we spend on lawyers and are spending on lawyers just to be legal, lawful, and proper.
There has to be some special considerations given by troopers when they're in rural Alaska, as happens in many cases, and I speak to the awareness that a general urban community has of the role of a police officer. I think that there has to be some changes made when you get to rural Alaska because of the change in environment, because of the cultural changes, that there has to be some concessions made on the part of the troopers so that that too can work to get a better understanding between officers.
Plus, I think the problem that there's no time and there's no clock and no calendar on the bush generally. You work at their speed and at their willingness to work with you.
What areas do you think the village councils can cooperate with the state troopers and vice versa?
I think one area that they could help, and this relates to everybody that represents in some degree the state of Alaska or the federal government. They need to identify very quickly for the village councils where regulations let off, where program policies let off, and where the law is. Those three areas are what we have to deal with when somebody comes to a village. And it's very hard to peg the difference because you can change regulations and you can change policies. And you have a tough time with law. I think that needs to be identified.
I feel that there has to be a certain amount of awareness among the community in rural Alaska so that they can be made aware of what to expect when a representative of law comes to their community. And they have to know specifically what they can, what they cannot do, what to expect. I think that this will do again much to enhance that cooperative communication that I think we're all commonly seeking. And in doing so, I would venture to say that this kind of a program should be taken up by the troopers whenever possible, so that and by whomever else we can get that can do it effectively, so that we have the understanding broken down in a dialogue that village people can know and understand and are familiar with, and this of course leads to that good solid communications.
Well, I believe that in the past, I'm certain that there have been areas of where we have, through need for hurry or the pressure of jobs to go on, there have been instances where we have avoided or ignored, if that's the word, the courtesy of contacting with the village council, the village corporation, or whatever a title they have. But in most instances, and in the past, I know that many times our calls for assistance come from the council, who are aware of the problem, and those are our initial contacts. And one thing that's contributed to maybe some of the problems that we've heard are in those days that I'm aware of, we were traveling with chartered aircraft, and it was expensive, and they were on standby, and we were trying to get our work done. Today, we've got availability of aircraft through our Division of Fish and Wildlife Protection. We're making roving patrols with our own aircraft where we can spend the time, and I think you'll see a great improvement, and probably over the last 2 years. Our people are instructed to make contact with the councils and the village policemen. Now the training is, there's an instant source right at the moment.
State trooper examinations include an appearance by examiners from police agencies as well as civilians. I asked Commissioner McQueen if Alaska Natives ever served on these examining boards.
Yes, they are. The composition of the board is a member of the state troopers or the Department of Public Safety, and the Division of Personnel, and a member at large from someone outside the state government system. We've used blacks and Indian peoples in these oral board presentations, and it's a volunteer basis, and from those people, and unpaid, by the way, and we do use them.
The reading comprehension test, what language is this given in?
You mean the basic entry exam?
Yes.
That is given in English.
Do you think, Mitch, that it should be in any other language?
I think that perhaps it's a point that is well taken, that again was brought up, the fact that in rural Alaska, law enforcement officers should be bilingual. So, you know, I think that it's a point that, it's a concept that will be developed further, I'm sure, as a product of this conference. And I certainly feel that it would do much to have bilingual enforcement officers, in the sense that they would be able to communicate effectively with, you know, all aspects of the community. There has to be some special considerations given to cultural backgrounds of prospective applicants, and in the it's the same old story of the Dick and Jane readers that have, you know, been around in our schools for rural Alaska through the years, that it just doesn't mean anything to us, and I think that the same considerations have to be, you know, given to trooper applications as well.
Bilingual is desired, but by the same token, he has to express himself in other areas and be able to explain to people outside his culture and be able to and effectively express the native people's wishes with other agencies. And I feel that he must have at those minimum qualifications for a state trooper in order to effectively do that.
Thanks to Mitch Dementiff and Roger Lang, Chuck Reed, and Donald McQueen of the State Troopers for their discussion of enforcing the law in the bush.
They can hear me too.
Potlatch, produced in the studios of KUAC in College in cooperation with KTOO Juneau, KOTZ Kotzebue, and KYUK Bethel, under Title I of the Higher Education Act.